The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Guy Jofredi to talk about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. This is episode 69, recorded on Thursday, October 30th at 9 in the evening. This podcast is sponsored by our partners Omnium and Upscaler.ch. Guy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. It's almost November already. It's been an exciting week, but we won't talk about that just yet. And that communication will come out in the next few weeks.
Very good. What are our topics today?
Today in the news, we'll discuss Get Your Guide, which just reached profitability and is now close to 1 billion euros in annual revenue. Then we'll talk about the investment speed of European VCs, a very interesting topic. After that, we'll look at the mega funds raised by Andreessen Horowitz, a 16Z, and Sequoia. In the deep dive, we'll discuss how much follow-on reserve we think makes sense for a VC fund. And finally, we'll answer a listener question about how much capital companies typically raise before reaching unicorn status. And of course, we'll end with a quick look at the top transactions of the week.
Let's start with a surprise question. Out of 80 analysts covering NVIDIA, how many currently rate it as sell? What do you think?
That's a great question. You hear and read so much about NVIDIA right now. Yesterday, they invested in Nokia. They're building a supercomputer with Eli Lilly for pharma. They're involved with OpenAI. And they plan to invest $5 billion in Intel. It feels like there's news about NVIDIA every single day. And just this week, the Financial Times reported that the company could soon reach a $5 trillion valuation. So I'd say there are very few sell ratings, maybe a handful at most, if any.
Exactly one. And it's from Jay Goldberg at Seaport Global Securities. I've never heard of that firm before. He's basically the lone bear among 73 bulls. 73 analysts recommend buying NVIDIA, 6 recommend holding, and only he has a sell rating. Goldberg believes we're living through an AI bubble, similar to the dot-com boom around 2000 when huge investments went into telecom infrastructure, like Cisco. But the expected internet usage took years to arrive. Cisco's stock crashed and never fully recovered. Goldberg warns that history could repeat itself. We're building massive AI data centers and investing billions, but if demand doesn't keep up, NVIDIA could face a painful correction. Just to be clear, this is not financial advice. Don't go shorting NVIDIA, that would be very risky. Still, I have to admit, the valuation is quite crazy. Anyway, let's move on to the week's first big news, about a Swiss startup that had somewhat faded from attention. Get Your Guide, the Swiss Berlin platform for travel activities, has announced profitability based on adjusted EBITDA with nearly 1 billion euros in annual revenue. In the third quarter of 2025, Get Your Guide increased its GMV by about 30% year over year and surpassed 10 million booked experiences. The company emphasized that the market for guided experiences and activities is far from a niche and continues to grow, positioning itself as the dominant player in the segment. So, Guy, now that Get Your Guide is profitable and approaching 1 billion in revenue, do you think the market for tours and experiences has finally matured, or are there risks that this trend could fade again?
This news is definitely a strong signal. Get Your Guide has proven that they can become profitable in what has traditionally been a very tough market with extremely high marketing costs. Almost a billion in revenue is impressive and shows the model works. Looking back, they've raised about 1.1 billion according to Crunchbase since their founding in 2009, which shows how much endurance it takes to reach profitability in such a space. The company is valued at around 2 billion euros today. Right now, travel demand is high, but I'd be cautious about calling this the global benchmark for the entire sector. Once the travel enthusiasm cools off or new formats appear, profitability could quickly come under pressure again.
Absolutely. Then I came across a PitchBook analysis showing that European VC funds are currently investing twice as fast as they're raising new capital. In other words, money is flowing out, but not much is coming in. In the first half of 2025, Only about 5.2 billion euros in new fund volume was raised across Europe, the lowest level in over 10 years. For comparison, in 2021, it was over 25 billion in the same period, five times as much. Still, many funds continue to invest at a surprisingly high pace. According to PitchBook, the ratio of invested to newly raised capital has doubled within a year, meaning managers are investing at last year's levels, even though the fundraising environment has completely changed. That's interesting because it could be interpreted in different ways. On one hand, maybe funds are seeing good opportunities right now and want to invest at better valuations. On the other, it could also mean that many funds feel pressure to deploy capital before the next fundraising cycle becomes difficult. How do you see it, Guy? Is this high investment pace a sign of confidence or a symptom of pressure to push capital into the market?
It's probably a mix of both. Many funds still sit on a lot of capital from the boom years of 2021 and 2022, and they need to invest it because their investment periods are ending. They have little choice. Either they invest or they never call the capital, which would make little sense, especially for management fees after the investment period. At the same time, there are many strong opportunities in Europe right now, particularly in AI, defense tech and climate tech, and transactions like Nexthink show that Europe can create true champions. Many venture capitalists want to be part of that story again. I also think the acceleration in the US, especially in AI, has created some FOMO among European investors. LPs are asking why so much is happening in the US but not here. That adds pressure. Another factor is that LPs are finally receiving distributions again from big exits, so they're more willing to meet capital calls. For a long time, many LPs couldn't or wouldn't do that, which limited VC's ability to invest. So now, with liquidity returning, it's natural that activity is picking up again. Hopefully that also means the fundraising environment will ease over the next 6 to 12 months, which would be great for everyone.
Let's move on to our third news topic. Two of the world's most well-known venture firms are going all in again. Andreessen Horowitz is reportedly raising $10 billion for the next tech wave, with about $6 billion for growth investments, $3 billion for AI startups, and $1 billion for so-called American dynamism projects, meaning defense and manufacturing technologies. That would be the biggest fund in the firm's history, even larger than the $7.2 billion they raised just last year. At the same time, Sequoia Capital announced $950 million in new early-stage funds, $750 million for Series A deals and $200 million for seed investments. Both moves show that despite talk of a potential AI bubble, Silicon Valley is fully back in growth mode. Guy, when Andreessen and Sequoia together raised nearly $11 billion in the middle of all this AI hype, what do you make of it? Is that proof that venture capital is back in full swing, or do you see it as the last stretch of an overheated market?
The last stretch, I like that. But seriously, when such established players raise this kind of money, it shows a lot of confidence. Raising $11 billion isn't something you do on a whim. They clearly believe the next wave of innovation in AI and defense tech is just beginning. But yes, they also have to deploy all that money somewhere, likely into companies like OpenAI and Anthropic. That pushes valuations even higher, which are already inflated. At some point, those returns need to be realized. If OpenAI is valued at $500 billion and they want a tenfold return, it would need to reach $5 trillion without dilution. That's a stretch, and when you look at those numbers, it does sound a bit bubble-like. Still, I'd say they're betting on the start of a new growth phase, not on a market peak.
How much do you think these two firms make in management fees per year combined?
Good question. I'd assume they don't use the standard 220 model, but more likely 230, 2% management fee and 30% carry. 2% on $11 billion means about $220 million per year. That's enough to hire quite a few people.
That's just the new funds I mentioned. right? Not their total assets. Actually, Andreessen manages $45 billion and Sequoia $56 billion. So together, that's around $1.5 billion in annual management fees, assuming 2%. That's insane when you think about it. Some of their funds even charge more than 2%. Even with a blended lower rate, that's a massive sum. If you divide that by headcount, it's still an incredible amount per employee. Makes you wonder what they do with all that cash.
Yeah, and they probably also pay fees to get access to deals or placement fees for the funds. That's certainly part of it too.
It would be fascinating to take a look at their P&L someday. You could probably learn a lot from it.
If you want to scale your startup fast and effectively, Upscaler.ch is the right program for you. It gives you access to a large network of founders, entrepreneurs, and investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited from over 500 workshops, scaling their business nationally and internationally. Find out more at www.upscaler.ch. And if you're raising a funding round, check out Omnium, the all-in-one digital platform for growth financing. Omnium streamlines your fundraising process from legal setup and investor KYC to payment handling. You can run a private round plus with access to 10,000 registered investors, or a fully public round for maximum visibility. With Omnium, you close your funding round faster and more successfully.
Let's move on to our deep dive topic for today, which is something many VCs are currently obsessed with: follow-on reserves. We're talking about something that every fund model includes, but very few people openly discuss: how much capital should a VC actually reserve for follow-ons? This week, I came across a provocative Substack post titled "Reserves Are a Scam." The author, James Heath, a British fund of funds investor, argues that many funds keep far too much money aside, often a third or more of the total fund, hoping they can double down later on their winners. But he says that rarely works in practice. You never really know which startups will become breakout successes. Some look slow at first and later turn into outliers, while others shoot up quickly and then fade. And by the time you've identified your real winners, the mega funds have already entered those rounds with ticket sizes you can't compete with. His point is that the best funds aren't the ones hoarding reserves, but those that invest early with full conviction. So, Guy, you've often said that many funds invest too cautiously. If Heath is right, then this whole follow-on logic is basically a safety net. Is keeping too much reserve a sign of weak conviction or just good portfolio management? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to make big general statements like Heath did, but in reality, it really depends on fund size and the strategy you set from the start. For smaller funds, reserves can actually be a matter of survival because you simply don't have a second fund to follow on or take your pro rata or to bridge at all. But of course, having too much reserve can be dangerous too if you invest only a small amount upfront and keep waiting and waiting for one company to become a champion. By the time it happens, the big funds are already there with massive valuations, and your follow-on just dilutes your overall return on that initial investment. You're playing for time instead of investing with conviction. I think it's a misconception when people say follow-ons are predictable or talk about a double-down strategy for the top 10% of the portfolio. The truth is, you recognize those top performers too late, and by then you've over-allocated to underperformers, which hurts the fund's total performance. Follow-ons aren't a safety net, they're a strategy, but a very hard one to execute. You really have to decide whether to invest with full conviction from the start and then do only selective pro rata and bridge rounds. Usually those who wait too long miss the moment when courage was still cheap.
That's interesting because I often feel follow-ons happen for the wrong reasons. Many LPs think it looks professional when a fund sets aside 30, 40, even 50% in reserves. It sounds disciplined, even conservative, though the idea of a conservative VC is already a contradiction in itself. But in the end, that money often doesn't go into the outliers, it goes into the struggling cases. You end up doing follow-ons because you need to support a company or because of a pay-to-play clause or simply to avoid dilution. So the question is, how big is the risk that follow-ons become a kind of protection shield for underperforming startups? That's a really good question. And yes, it's definitely a real risk. I've seen many portfolios where VCs use follow-ons defensively rather than offensively. They don't double down on winners. Instead, they rescue the lame ducks. It's partly psychology. No one wants to admit they were wrong. So they do one more bridge round, another small ticket, and in the end, they just dilute their overall returns when the case doesn't take off. In defensive follow-ons, it's crucial to negotiate clearly with the founders and set concrete milestones. Then you can secure a fair valuation and a defensive follow-on can actually work. But you need to know the company inside out. It can't be a gut decision. It has to be driven by facts. And about the power law, one of our favorite topics. It only works when you make your winners bigger, whether defensively or offensively, not when you keep extending the middle ground. Still, I believe that lame ducks can sometimes turn into winners. We've seen that ourselves in some cases where we invested and later did follow-ons. Max, you're very deliberate about fund architecture. If we were to reduce follow-ons and go more all-in up front, what would that mean for fundraising? Do you think LPs would accept a model with, say, only 10 or 15% in reserves, or would that be a red flag right away? Good question. I think we know LPs are creatures of habit. They love models they already understand. 30% sounds familiar, 10% sounds risky. But with data-driven deal flow, better analytics, and AI tools, you can actually make that argument today. You can say, we invest more precisely, so we don't need to hold as much back. We do longer due diligence. We analyze deeper. The key is to explain that discipline lies in timing, not in percentages. That's also how we built Koyo. Our fund invests a large portion upfront because we want to secure meaningful ownership in the Series A startups we back and our LPs. And we've brought quite a few on board in our first closing, find that thesis compelling. Of course, our approach isn't for everyone. Some find it too aggressive or unconventional because we only do 10 investments instead of the usual 30. But we do it out of conviction, and we are conviction investors. I've seen what doesn't work, rushing into deals, making snap decisions in 48 hours. That almost never works in venture capital. That's why I'm convinced our thesis and our approach will work. Investing big from the start to secure a strong position on the cap table and have real influence.
Exactly. And by being strategically close to our portfolio companies, we can plan preemptive bridge rounds early, raise them internally or externally, and make sure every financing round is aligned with long-term success. Let's touch quickly on AI startups, which we've been talking about a lot lately. They scale very differently. Do you think that means we have to completely rethink the classic reserve model since cycles are shorter and early rounds are much larger?
Yes, exactly. With AI startups, it's obvious. Capital needs shift forward. You see much larger pre-seed and seed rounds, but often less need for later stage capital. That speaks for front-loading, investing heavily early instead of saving too much for later. Follow-ons should always remain flexible, but not fixed. I always say, less Excel, more conviction, but with clear triggers for when a follow-on truly makes sense.
Or you invest slightly later, like we do at Koyo, where companies are already close to profitability and can then raise strong growth rounds from there.
Exactly. So reserves aren't a scam, but they're also not a safety net. In the end, it's about strategy, discipline, and courage, not percentages. Whoever waits too long for the next round might miss the bet that mattered from the very beginning.
Or to put it differently, conviction beats caution.
Speaker one, well said. Conviction. That's a big theme for us at Koyo too. Let's move on to the listener question from Julia in Chur. Julia wants to know how much capital a startup typically raises to reach that magical $1 billion valuation to become a unicorn. And according to a recent analysis by Stanford professor Ilya Strebulaev, the magic number is $340 million in equity. That's much higher than I expected. The median is around $250 million. The largest group of unicorns, about 370 companies, raised between $200 and $300 million, including Peloton, for example. But there are also frugal ones. Companies like Snap or NetSuite became unicorns with less than $200 million in funding. On the other end, you have capital-intensive cases like Neuralink or Databricks, which needed up to $500 million or even more than a billion, like Cabbage. Strebulaev's conclusion is clear. The path to unicorn status fundamentally depends on successful fundraising. The correlation is evident. So, Guy, I've got two questions for you. How much of this is magic and how much is simply fundraising mechanics? Are startups becoming unicorns more through capital marketing than product quality? In other words, can you still become a unicorn today mainly through fundraising talent?
Good question. Magical stories or house of cards companies are usually the ones that get funded well because there's a charismatic founder with a great story. People believe it, others follow, and momentum builds. I think what Strebulaev shows here is a reality check. A unicorn is not some mythical creature. It's the result of a perfectly orchestrated sequence of funding rounds. Fundraising has become its own craft. Those who master it align story, numbers, and timing so precisely that valuations rise with every round. That doesn't mean product and market don't matter. They're just the ticket to play. The real lever is whether you can deploy capital efficiently to buy growth. Many unicorns, in my view, are fundraising champions with great strategies and flawless execution.
So the road to unicorn status is basically a pitch marathon, right?
Absolutely. Especially in the current environment, access to capital determines everything. Those who still get good terms today either have extreme traction or a very strong cap table.
When you look at Swiss scale-ups, how far along are they by comparison? Does it just take longer here because less capital is available, or is there something deeper behind it?
A bit of both. Switzerland has incredible technology quality, but structurally smaller rounds, already from pre-seed to Series A. In the US, startups raise 150 to 200 million between Series A and C, often more. Here, those rounds combined are more like 30 to 50 million, sometimes less. That stretches the timeline. Our companies take longer to become globally visible. They're more capital efficient, yes, but because it takes longer to raise funds, reaching unicorn status also takes longer. You could say we build more camels than unicorns, companies that scale sustainably and survive when the market tightens. I like that analogy. Also, founders in the US or Israel start out with the ambition to build a unicorn. In Switzerland, engineers focus first on product and technology development. That mindset is deeply rooted, which makes scaling slower. They don't pitch global dominance or $10 billion exits in their first decks. In the US, it's built into the DNA. That's an advantage. They integrate fundraising strategy into company building from day one. It's something we always discuss with our founders too, how to align vision, capital strategy, and milestones from the start.
Let's start with the biggest Swiss tech news of the week. Vista Equity Partners has acquired a majority stake in Nexthink, valuing the company at $3 billion. That officially makes Nexthink one of Europe's most valuable software firms.
Yes, that's a great milestone. Vista is one of the world's most renowned private equity investors, specializing in enterprise software. They manage over $100 billion and usually invest in companies that are already profitably scaling.
Exactly. And Nexthink has proven just that. Over the years, they've become the global leader in digital employee experience, or DEX, with more than 1,500 enterprise clients and 25 million employees using their platform to monitor and optimize IT performance, apps, and networks in real time.
Yes, and it's a true Swiss success story. Pedro Bados founded Nexthink in 2004 at EPFL in Lausanne, later expanding to Lausanne and Boston, a Swiss-born company that scaled globally. I heard recently that EPFL still benefits through some licensing agreements, so the ecosystem wins as well.
Before this deal, Nexthink had raised about $330 to $340 million in venture funding. The last round, a 180 million Series D in 2021, was led by Permira at a valuation of around $1.1 billion, with Highland Europe and Index Ventures also participating.
Yes, and looking at this exit dynamic from a $1.1 billion valuation to $3 billion in 4 years, that's nearly a tripling in value. Especially impressive because Nexthink didn't ride a hype wave like generative AI, but grew through a stable enterprise use case.
Vista clearly sees huge potential, especially now that agentic AI is entering IT management. NextHink plans to integrate generative and agent-based AI functions into its DEX platform, systems that act proactively, detect issues, and fix them autonomously.
Exactly. An exit in the nine-figure range like this is another strong signal that the Swiss startup ecosystem is maturing. It proves that Switzerland can be a unicorn factory. It also silences skeptics who said Swiss exits would stay capped at 50 to 80 million.
A great closing note, from EPFL to a $3 billion deal. That's deep tech, made in Switzerland.
Let's move on to the next deal, this time in health tech and from Solothurn. Cumea has brought in a new investor, Danish private equity fund, GRO, to accelerate its European expansion.
GRO isn't a typical VC, but a selective growth and private equity investor from Copenhagen focusing on B2B software. For Cumea, this is a strong signal. They're moving from a pure VC phase into real scale-up mode.
Yes, Cumea was founded in 2019 and has developed an AI-powered radar technology that detects patient movement anonymously. No cameras, no microphones. The software analyzes data in real time and alerts staff automatically in critical situations like falls or irregular behavior.
And with remarkable impact. According to studies, clinics using Cumea have reduced their fall rates by an average of 74%. That eases the burden on nursing staff, saves costs, and improves patient safety.
Exactly, and they're already widely used. Cumea operates in more than 130 healthcare facilities, mainly in the DACH region and Scandinavia. They now have 40 employees, and with GRO on board, they're planning to accelerate expansion across Europe.
Yes, and what I personally like is that they're one of the few health tech startups that truly anchor data privacy as a core value. No video, no audio data, privacy first. That fits perfectly with Europe's ethical standards in healthcare.
Absolutely, and it's a great example of how Swiss deep tech can evolve from hospital use cases into scalable software platforms. Congrats to Cyril and also to Tim, who recently joined the team.
Let's move on to the energy tech scene. Another strong funding round has closed. Exnaton from Zurich announced its Series A, led by 4 Impact Capital and Elevator Ventures, with participation from existing investors True Ventures and Uber Morgan.
Exnaton develops an AI-based software platform for energy providers. It helps them launch new power products like dynamic tariffs, energy sharing, or smart charging quickly and cost-efficiently without having to rebuild their entire IT infrastructure.
Exactly. The startup sits right at the intersection of digitalization and the energy transition. More than 50 utilities in Europe are already using the platform, including Total Energies, Eprimo, Bayernwerk, and Burgenland Energy.
The founding team around Lilian Ableitner, Arne Miewe, and Anselma Werner comes from ETH Zurich, the University of St. Gallen, and TU Munich. They combine academic research and business experience to turn energy data into tangible business models.
And with this round, they plan to accelerate both European expansion and AI development of the platform. Another great example of Swiss startups scaling research directly into the energy market.
Yes, and to wrap up, let's move into the crypto space. Falcon X, one of the leading global digital asset brokers, has acquired the Swiss company 21 Shares, the world's largest issuer of crypto ETPs and ETFs.
Exactly. 21 Shares was founded in 2018 by Hani Rashwan and Ophelia Snyder and now manages over $11 billion across 55 listed products. They made crypto investing mainstream within regulated structures, from Zurich to the global stage.
And Falcon X brings institutional-grade infrastructure to the table with over $2 trillion in trading volume and more than 2,000 institutional clients. Together, they aim to bridge digital assets and traditional financial markets.
21 Shares will remain independent under the Falcon X umbrella, but the combination of product expertise and trading infrastructure creates a real heavyweight in the global digital asset market.
Yes, and it's also a fantastic exit for the Swiss crypto scene. It shows once again that our ecosystem produces top quality companies and that Switzerland can build global champions even in this field.
Guy, we've hit the 40-minute mark. It's been a while since we wrapped up this quickly. That's it for Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you'd like to support us, please subscribe to our newsletter and share it within your network. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next time with episode 70. Have a great weekend. Take care and goodbye.